Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts, literally, to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. The 1970s was an amazing time to be born into the world of cinema. For the first time, it became an academic subject in universities across the country, and many of the nation's largest halls of learning were opening flourishing film schools. It was a decade in which the muckety-mucks of the big studios lost control of their fiefdoms, learned that they had no idea what to do in the post-Easy Rider world when young audiences took control of what they wanted to see, and it wasn't Dr. Doolittle or the standard studio pap of the era. Movies were being taken over by the Young Turks, as young as their audiences, and they took risks. They mixed things up. They were passionate and creative, and in many senses, the studios, bewildered by what movie audiences wanted, ceded their power in many ways to the filmmakers who were more closely connected to what ticket buyers were looking for in their entertainment. The old guys in the gray hair and the coats and ties gave way to the new generation who wouldn't be caught dead in a suit. The film schools offered up George Lucas, John Carpenter, Steven Spielberg, and a ton of others. A lot of what happened in the 70s was a flash in the pan before those in the seats of power got a handle on it when a lot of the experimental work at the time crashed and burned in their own conflagrations. But Carpenter, Spielberg, Lucas, and so many more still are making our entertainment, and their influence will continue to be felt for many years to come. Talent is one thing, but versatility and evolution are crucial to long-lived careers in film. Our guest today, John Badham, started directing television in the early 70s, even working on Rod Serling's Night Gallery alongside his contemporary Steven Spielberg. But the range of his work is astonishing and constantly blooming with every change in the heart and technology of filmmaking. You want a musical? Saturday Night Fever. Classic horror, the 1979 Dracula. Cyber thriller, War Games. Action thriller, Blue Thunder. Comedy thriller, Stakeout. The list is endless, and he's still going strong. We'll get John on the postmortem slab to find out what makes him tick right after this. Fangoria Magazine is back and better than ever in a deluxe 100-page quarterly edition. Each issue includes set visits, deep dives, new discoveries, and minimal ads, all printed on collectible-grade paper stock that reimagines the classic magazine for a 2019 audience. You'll see familiar names like Michael Gingold and Tony Timpone, and you'll see bylines that will leave your jaw on the floor, like Barbara Crampton. And the best part, it's print only, just like the old days. Go to Fangoria.com to subscribe today. For over 15 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers around the world. Diabolik offers a one-stop shopping experience for all of your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabro, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. Whether you're looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice for all of the demented discs you have been craving. So where did it start? You were the son of an army officer. You were born in the UK. You went to Yale. Where did the love of cinema begin for you?
Well, I suppose probably going back as early as 5 or 6 years old. My mother was an actress in England, and then when we came to the United States after World War II, she started acting locally where we were living in Birmingham, Alabama.
Right.
And in
your
in
father had originally
there.
Been from Alabama, right?
And he was from there, and he brought us. He was a general in the Air Force, had been a general in the Army, which then became the United States Air Force in 47. So he had lived his whole life in Birmingham, brought us back where he was president of a big construction company, and we started to live there. It was a very exciting time for me at 5 or barely 6 years old, seeing a whole new culture, a culture shock from war-torn England to, you know, a racially torn Birmingham, Alabama, you know, quite a shock to see it, to try to even understand, grapple with what in the world is going on with these people. But I followed my mother around to many rehearsals of plays that she was in, and then
so she did theater more than
she did
than
theater.
Cinema.
But then she started doing a radio show that she had for almost 20 years.
Wow!
And one of the first television shows, local television shows like morning chat type things,
right?
That you know that now the big networks all have. But she was doing that every day, and I used to go with her. So I really developed a love of theater and was doing a lot of acting in college and even in high school. But then, as I'm starting to think about maybe I'd like to be an actor, I also started to realize everybody else was getting cast but me.
I'm getting being told something.
I'm getting the spear carrier that stands over in the corner. I'm getting the nurse who goes this way, doctor. So. And I thought, what else can I do? And somebody came walking down the hall of the Yale Drama School at this time. This guy's being followed by all of these women. And I said, who's that? Said, that's the director. Oh, boy. Boy, can I do that job? And so I literally started directing as an undergraduate at Yale and then went to Yale Drama School. Now, this is all theater.
Because so as the you theater said, is where it started, and the difference between cinema and theater seems to be pretty vast.
Huge.
For a director.
Huge. And at the time, as you said earlier, there were no film courses at Yale, certainly, except for maybe a history of film course that was regarded as a gut course, meaning you just take it because you could go to the movies, you know, once a week, whenever class was, but nothing serious, and people that were working in movies were kind of looked down upon. But then a very strange thing happened. My mother calls me one day and says, your sister Mary is going to be in a movie with Gregory Peck.
This is amazing.
I'm going, what the fuck? What? Are you kidding me? I'm up here on scholarship, you know, and dog sandwiches. And my 9-year-old sister is going to be in a movie with Gregory. How did this happen? Well, when To Kill a Mockingbird was being made as a film, they had decided that they wanted to look all over the country for who was going to play the three children.
So they came to Alabama.
In the film, they came to Alabama, having seen at that point about 2,000 children.
Wow.
And not getting anywhere. They'd seen all the Los Angeles children, the New York children, and other big cities, but couldn't find anything that was real. And they went to the local theater, and the artistic director there called my mother and said, "Don't you have a daughter who's about 9? Why don't you bring her down for this?"
Right.
So she took Mary down there, and Mary did a whole improvisation for them that they got her to do. Next thing I knew, she was going to New York to be tested, and then she got this movie where they were going to pay her $500 a week.
Wow.
Whoa. For 10 weeks.
Wow. Okay. Had she studied acting at all, or it was all you doing all of that and her mother being
I'm up actor? Studying acting and directing and stuff like that, and she's just being Mary. And,
just being a 9-year-old Southern girl.
Yeah, playing with her friends and stuff like that.
Oh, man. And she gets nominated for an Oscar.
She gets nominated for an Oscar. It's all very exciting for her.
Unbelievable.
And I'm in New Haven in the wintertime, freezing. But, it's terrific. It's really exciting because we all love the novel, which was out by then.
Yeah.
But when I got out of, graduated from the drama school, Mary got a job in a Twilight Zone.
Right.
And was coming out to be in the Twilight Zone, and I was able to come along.
And that was Earl. Earl wrote that one, didn't
Earl
he?
Hamner.
Yeah, Earl Hamner
yes,
wrote that
yes,
one.
Yes, you're right.
He used
good.
To live down the street from us.
Oh, okay.
And a sweet, sweet man.
Yes, yeah. It was an episode called The Bewitching Pool.
Right, right.
So I was able to hang out on the set, and it was the first time I'd gotten to see films being made. And
so that was the window to filmmaking from behind the door for your first time was on the set of The Twilight Zone.
That's right.
Wow.
And, talking to the producer, Bill Frug, at the time, who said, well, come out here, look around, see what you can find.
Yeah.
I had to do 6 months in the Army because Vietnam was starting to heat up and everything was getting intense. So I went and did my 6 months National Guard duty.
That's a quick stint, only 6 months.
Well, then you have to do 5.5 years of
in the reserves,
yeah. Reserve duty. Hmm. I spent a lot of time at the Van Nuys Airport.
Oh, really?
on weekends once a month.
So you came out after Yale. You moved out to California?
I moved out here and started seeing people and trying to, find a job, any kind of job.
Right.
People say, what do you want to do? Well, I'd like to direct. Oh, great. Well, what have you directed? Plays.
Mm-hmm.
Get the fuck out of here. Go next. and
in California, they don't know from plays, right?
Plays, just, oh, yuck. Oh. But I kept looking and finally landed a job in the mailroom at Universal.
Really? Okay.
Again, thanks to my sister.
Oh, wow.
Because I think my mom said something to Gregory Peck, who said, well, have him come in and see me. And
wow.
I went in and talked to him, and he called up Jennings Lang, who was the head of television, and Jennings Lang said, well, send him over to personnel. And I put in an application. But the HR people said to me, we're not really interested in any creative types. We really want business types here, to be in our mailroom. I mean, they're going to be part of management soon. Uh-huh, okay, well. And I guess part of the point of the story is these kind of accidental things keep happening.
Sure.
One Friday afternoon in the mailroom, two guys simultaneously said, I quit. I can't take this stupid job anymore.
Opening the grand position to you of mail.
And suddenly, you know, my name is about on the top of the pile, probably because of Jennings Lang's call. Mm. And I go in on a Monday morning and meet 12 guys, everybody who has bachelor's degrees, and four of us with master's degrees.
Wow.
In, you know, in some kind of theater or film. And the idea was that you would spend your time in the mailroom not only delivering mail, but getting to know all the various departments and the various places and find something that interests you. So if you were interested in being a designer, art director or something, you could be hanging around the art department, or same right. with cinematography or editing or publicity. There was just so many places to go.
You learn so much, so many departments, and it's naked to you then suddenly.
Yeah, and just finding what's right for you. And they really wanted to see how much get up and go you had on your own. If you were there for a couple of years and hadn't moved out of the mailroom, they would move you out, just say goodbye.
Right, churn. Yeah.
Next. Let's get somebody else who's got more drive.
Yeah.
And I wound up training as a casting director.
Yes. And you were in casting for?
I was in casting for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And doing shows like Run for Your Life.
Right.
And a series called The Bold Ones.
Right.
Then, and I hooked up with a producer, Bill Sackheim, who had just come over to Universal, and we hit it off. And next thing you know, I'm helping him, and we did a pilot with Vince Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Suicide Hotline pilot.
Right.
Wow, I can't imagine why it didn't work. Let's go watch somebody kill themselves.
Yeah. No, that's entertaining.
I hope they do it in the side of the head instead of the front. I'm so tired of seeing that, you know.
Might work now.
Oh, God, not pills again.
Netflix, do you hear?
Yeah. Yes. But ABC looked at the pilot, and they said to Bill, they said, yeah, but what's the series going to be about? Which is a typical network idiotic question.
Right.
You know, you can't tell watching the show.
Right.
Well, Bill decided that we needed to make a little 3-minute promo where he would have the director, Jerry Thorpe, and Vince Edwards, and somebody else in a projection room. And the lights come up and say, oh, that looks like an interesting, what's the show going to be about? And now the three of these guys would do it.
Right.
One morning, I'm in the shower, and I said, I could direct that. Yeah. I know I, Bill, could I direct this little promo that we're going to do? And he went, I never forget, he didn't even blink. He went, sure, absolutely. Oh, my God.
Your first celluloid direction.
And I've got the crew for an entire day. In the projection building at Universal. So rather than just sitting in the projection room, the lights come up and the guys say, oh, what's it going to be about? And now they start walking down the corridors and down the steps, getting some water and going to the bathroom, but chatting all the way. Right. And we sent it over with the series, which sold. But then Bill said, you know, you could direct a whole episode of this new show we're going to do with Hal Holbrook called The Senator.
Ah, I remember The Senator.
And so I did. I got to direct episode number 7. We made 8.
Oh, and squeaked in under the wire.
And again, here comes luck. So episode number 8 comes along. There's a director who's written the script. Producer wants to make a few little changes in the script. Director gets very huffy and quits. And about the time that he quits, I come walking into producer's office, David Levinson, and he's sitting there with Hal Holbrook, and they look up, and they look at each other, and they smirk, and they said, you're going to do the 8th show. And I worked on that. It came out. It got really good notices, and suddenly I got an Emmy nomination for my second show.
Wow!
Like what? And the producer, the director who quit, was totally angry at me.
Right.
He's walking over my dead body to get an Emmy nomination with my script. And oh my God!
Sorry.
Yes.
Sorry. So that began an amazing directorial career. This, you step into, a lot of people have to go through independent movies or cobble together things. You, similar to me, your first job was in network television, and it's a different experience, but there were so many shows, you were in demand, you were doing a lot of stuff, and at this time, I guess 1971 or so was when this started, and the Night Gallery experience is something that will be particularly interesting to our audience because of the genre trappings. What was that like? Did you work with? I know that Rod Serling really was just the host and not so much creator-producer as much as he was on Twilight Zone, but what was your experience on that show?
Well, my mentor, Bill Sackheim, was the producer of the pilot that was directed by Barry Scheer and Boris Segal and Steven Spielberg.
Right.
His very first professional job.
His Joan Crawford episode.
His Joan Crawford episode. And part of my job was to, you know, just to stick by him and help him in any way that he needed help.
And he was 21 years old at
and
the time.
And he was 21 and absolutely terrified of Joan Crawford.
Yeah.
She invited him to dinner, and he called me up and said, "Will you go with me?" I don't know. okay, I'll go.
We had
the most fun dinner ever with her, as she dished on Betty Davis and, you know, Hollywood in general.
Amazing.
And you know, couldn't believe that she was going to be working with a 21-year-old director. You know, thinking of all the directors she must have worked with.
Well, 40 years ago, you and I met doing an interview for the Z Channel. And at that same time, on that same interview show, Steven Spielberg had come on. And I had asked him what it was like being 21 years old to direct Joan Crawford in the show. And he said, "What do you think it was like being 21 years old and directing Joan Crawford?" He said it was totally intimidating to him, and it even to that day, it made him shake a little to think about it. So,
well, he just did great. I mean, he was
it's an amazing show.
You would not have known that he was intimidated if you were just watching him work.
Yeah,
and work with not only Joan Crawford, but then when Rod Serling came in to do all the introductions, he directed Rod Serling in that and got the whole style of the show set up.
Mm. Now, what about your work on the show and your experience with Serling, with the whole production?
Well, I got along great with him. My first interaction was looking at his introduction to the pilot episode, and he had written an introduction that was like about a page and a half single space long, which, as we know, is really long.
Yes.
And I'm looking at it, and I said to Bill Sackheim, "This is really long. You know, maybe we should cut it down and not be, you know, throwing away a lot of stuff." And Bill said, "Well, call him up and tell him to cut it down." "And you want me to call up Rod Serling?" So I called him up and told him. Well, he right away started ranting and raving and said, "They don't pay me enough to do this kind of editorial stuff. And,
really?
And I don't know why, you know, we need to do this. It should be plenty." Thank goodness I had some foresight. My brain was actually working that day, and I had suggested some cuts on paper. And I said, well, Mr. Serling, what about if we, you know, made this edit right here? Yeah, fine. That's good. Okay, good. Great. So that was our meeting. But the first show that I did on Night Gallery was something called The Boy Who Predicted Earthquakes, mm-hmm. that he had written and was an original. And it was so exciting. It was with Ronnie Howard's younger brother, Clint Howard, who was like 6 years old at the time. And he had to carry this whole episode.
Wow.
And he's such a good actor. Well, you know, we knew Ronnie was a great actor.
Right.
And I had, when I was a casting director, I had worked with Clint on another show. So I knew that he would be just fine.
And what was the first movie that excited you? What made you want to be a filmmaker? Was it you'd already been doing theater and then this other medium had the magnetism to you? Or was there a movie that made you go, God, I want to do that?
Well, the things that we were seeing at Yale were Ingmar Bergman, like The Seventh Seal, the 400 Blows, Godard films. You know, those were the classy things.
Right, the art house fair.
The art house stuff. But also, they're running a lot of movies on campus. That's the first time I got to see Citizen Kane.
Wow.
And, you know, completely swept away by that for good reason. So
Yale is where the love of cinema came from?
Where the love of cinema came from, and being really interested in, you know, A, not only working with actors, but the whole visual side of it and telling stories in that particular way. And I had never taken a film course by the time I started directing. It was just all by trying to hang around directors like Michael Ritchie and Joe Sargent, Lamont Johnson, guys who were doing television at that time.
But Michael doing really was, amazing television.
And yes, yeah. They were terrific. And, you know, studying from them, you know, hanging out on the set with them, watching what they were doing.
So you bring a personality to your films, and we'll get into the film specifically in a minute, but it's a schizophrenic personality. You're able to take on a comedy, a thriller, a horror film, a musical, and they still feel personal. What's your process when you start a movie? Do you imbue a personality from the beginning and try to give it a certain language each time out?
Well, I think when it's worked the best is when the characters really speak to me, and I understand the characters, usually from a kind of a humorous point of view.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I loved upon reading the script for Saturday Night Fever, mm-hmm. which was then called Tribal Rights of the New Saturday Night.
Interesting. Oh, that's based on a magazine article.
Based
right?
on a magazine, New York Magazine article, mm-hmm. that was called Tribal Rights of the New Saturday Night. And
trips off the tongue.
And what do I know about Brooklyn? Zip, zero, nada, nunca. I mean, there is nothing I know about Brooklyn except it's somewhere close to Manhattan.
Right.
And yet that character spoke to me, jumped off the page, and I said, I understand this guy, even though, you know, I've been in Birmingham for all these years,
right.
or New Haven, which is, you know, more insular type of thing. I really get it. I get this family. And I was really excited about it. And so,
were you listening to music at the time? Were you, do you play an instrument?
I kind of play the piano. But I did not know who the Bee Gees were.
Oh, really?
I mean, I just vaguely heard of them. And when I walked in for my first meeting with Robert Stigwood, the producer, he hands me a tape cassette. Now, we all remember tape cassettes, those little square things that would all tangle up and
yes,
get all exactly. screwed up in your car and you have to throw them away. He said, on this cassette, there are 3 number one hits, 5 songs. The Bee Gees have done 5 songs here for the movie, and 3 of them are number one hits. And I said, are these finished? Said, no, they're demos. Uh-huh. I thought, how ridiculous. How does somebody know that it's going to be three number one hits? We all know, as William Goldman said, that nobody knows anything.
Right, exactly.
And how do you know this?
And Stigwood was a manager and owned his record
manager,
label and all of that.
Yeah, yeah. And he was a record guy. So I said, oh, well, where do they go in the movie? He said, well, that's your job.
Ah.
I said, great, thank you. I can do that. I know what to do with these. I'll figure it out. So actually, at the end of the day, I was delighted to know that Stigwood was just dead wrong about that three number one hits.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there were four.
Yeah, okay.
That was, Pretty oh, terrible. God.
Yeah. He'll learn his lesson.
And the very last one I put in the movie, because we just had nowhere else to put it, I just kind of slotted it in a space. That turned out to be the first of the number one hits.
Wow.
How Deep Is Your Love?
Oh, wow. Well, the... directing a musical is, I mean, you're directing a drama for the most part, a very powerful, family type drama of a neighborhood. But the rhythm and the way you shoot musical numbers and cut them and play it to the music and the like is really impressive. There's an energy, a musical energy throughout that. And I just wondered what that approach was from the beginning, if you felt that you were musical before, or this brought that out in you, and how you managed to fabricate the movie that is so filled with musical life.
Well, I had worked during the summers at Yale. I had worked in musical theater and stage managed a lot of wonderful musicals, West Side Story and Carousel and Three Penny Opera and things like that, and really enjoyed doing that. I mean, it's just great, great fun to be running a big musical from backstage and be part of it. An interesting thing happened before getting involved with Saturday Night Fever, which was me going to see in New York The Wiz.
Ah.
And I learned after seeing it that 20th Century Fox had bought the rights to it, but then got cold feet and turned it around back to Motown, just back to the producers. Mm-hmm. And I went to my friend Rob Cohen, who was working at Motown, and said, why don't we get this for Motown to do? And so Universal and Motown together bought the rights for The Wiz, and Rob and I started adapting the musical into what would be the screenplay.
Interesting.
We were on it for a few weeks, and the call came in that said, you know, we want you to cast Diana Ross as Dorothy. and I said, well, guys, since we started this, I've been reading the originals, L. Frank Baum. She was 6 years old. And at the time they made the movie, you know, they put a grown-up, you know, almost grown-up adolescent in there, Judy Garland.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I totally understood. Now I knew 6 years old about Tin Men and Cowardly Lions. That's a six-year-old girl's point of view.
Right.
And that's kind of the way The Wiz is being told on Broadway, too. You know, this little girl seeing these fantastical creatures. And with Diana Ross, it seems to me like it would be kind of neurotic. I mean, God bless her. She's a great singer and a great actress and a wonderful dancer. I mean, you can't take anything away from her except for it's just like the wrong casting.
Right.
Well, this went on for weeks, and it got to a head. And I was talking to my father about it. Still a retired general in the Air Force, and he said, "Well, Johnny, don't quit, or they won't pay you."
And
wise. So I'm going, yeah, you're right, Dad. What do I do? I said, I've got to figure some way. How can I get out of this? I mean, everybody knew my feelings about it,
right?
And it got down to the point of a big meeting up in the president of Universal's office, in Ned Tannen's office, mm-hmm. and with other biggies, Tom Mount and Berry Gordy came over from Motown.
Yeah.
And we're going to resolve all this casting business. And I said, you know, I know how to work this with Dorothy and with Diana Ross now. And everybody kind of looked knowingly around the room, you know, like, okay, the guy's folding.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, this meeting will be over shortly here. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was going to be over shortly, but not the way they thought. I said, I saw a movie last week on television with Robert Montgomery, and it was called The Lady in the Lake.
Oh. Okay.
And they said, yeah, so? I said, Robert Montgomery, it's all done from his point of view. You never see him
right
in the whole thing, except maybe his feet or a quick reflection
in a mirror.
Yeah. You know, you just, why don't we do that with Diana Ross, where we can see her feet, we can hear her sing, you know, but it's all her point of view. And they go, you're kidding, right? I said, no. I think this would be really an inventive way to do it. Well, the temperature dropped about 40 degrees in the room. The meeting broke up. The next morning, they're calling my agent, Sam Adams, to say, we're going to work it out with this guy. So now there I am, jobless.
Wow.
And not a few weeks later, there's going to be a change of directors on Tribal Rights of the New Saturday Night, because they're having creative differences
right.
of the first sort. And John Avildsen and Robert Stigwood were butting heads over the script.
And Avildsen had done Rocky, famously.
Avildsen had an Academy Award nomination for Rocky. And like the same day, Stigwood said, well, congratulations and goodbye.
Wow. And it opened a big door to you.
A big door to
and
me.
You'd only done one movie before that, and that was Bingo Long and His Traveling All-Stars, if I'm not
right.
mistaken.
Right, which had a lot of musical elements in it.
Right.
And Stigwood had asked me if I was interested in doing a picture that he wanted to do. That was called Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Oh, yes.
Which I knew to stay away from as far as possible.
Yeah.
Because the script was just not something I understood.
Mm. And blasphemous to those Beatle fans around the world.
Yes, and yeah. I was one of the biggest Beatles fans.
Me too.
You know, with a giant poster of Sergeant Pepper on my wall.
Nice.
You know, so when I saw the title of the script, I went, oh no, this is going to be cheesy, maybe.
And it was.
but anyway, I was on his mind, and suddenly, next thing you know, I'm being called to come to New York and take over this script, which I had read here in L.A. and just gone bonkers for.
Yeah.
Said, this I understand, this I get. I get the musical side of it. And the fact that on The Wiz, I had been looking at almost every really good musical ever made and studying how the dances were shot and how the difference between Fred Astaire shooting, Busby Berkeley shooting, Gene Kelly, and Robert Fosse.
Right.
You know, such different styles. And the Fosse style appealed to me a lot, you know, but could I shoot like that? Probably wouldn't have that schedule, but, you know, that the energy of the camera work and the dynamics of it, as opposed to the Fred Astaire dynamics, which are much more passive. Let's just record Astaire doing his thing.
Have a get frame him and let him.
Full, get him full yeah. figure and just kind of just go wherever he goes and that'll be fine. As opposed to Fosse, who would go in and shoot inserts of people crooking their little finger, and it would be part of the dance.
Details.
And you can see it in, especially in All That Jazz, where he's really comfortable with shooting dance.
Did that influence Saturday Night Fever?
He hadn't done all that jazz yet. By the time I did Saturday Night Fever, yeah. but I, you know, watched the work that he had in Sweet Charity.
Mm-hmm. Live musical theater was so vibrant and the music and all so exciting, but there's a lot of cinema at work in Saturday Night Fever, and they work mm-hmm. really well hand in hand. What was your study of the technology of how to edit, how to shoot, how to, you know, were there films that you were inspired by, or was this something basically you just dove in and attacked?
Well, after looking at lots of musicals, just starting to get a sense of the feeling of it, and how we could best show off the dances and enhance them with how we were shooting. So it really was a matter of kind of feel more than any specific thing.
Intuition. Really.
Yes, we're staging it with the choreographer, staging the dance numbers, and then working out how we could use moving camera to shoot it, and not just have, you know, big wide static shots, but get right in there with them. Now this is at the very birth of Steadicam, right around that time. Steadicam was only 2 or 3 years old,
and so had just have Garrett Brown
and so Panavision had ripped off Garrett Brown.
Oh,
and created a device called the Panaglide.
Right.
Which was basically a Steadicam.
Exactly.
And Garrett Brown sued the bejesus out of them and won. Mm-hmm. They had to abandon it. But at that point in between, that's what we were renting and using. And the New York camera operators were getting used to using it. There weren't a lot of trained Steadicam operators around.
Mm-hmm.
But between using that and a lot of handheld camera work.
Mm-hmm.
In some of the sequences with Travolta dancing by himself, that big solo dance number he does in the middle, my camera operator was on his knees on just a little rolling, like mechanics platform, like you go under a car with.
Right.
and the dolly grip, basically taking hold of the operator's shoulder and his belt, and moving him around, so that the dolly grip had been a circus guy, circus acrobat.
Oh my God!
So that when you watched them working with Travolta, you had Travolta, the camera, and the dolly grip, and they were all in dead sync with each other, you know, and it was wonderful just to watch the phenomenon of how they did it, because we wanted to get in really tight on Travolta with very wide angle lenses. So they were maybe 18 inches away from him, but getting, you know, at least a knee figure with the wide angle and canting the camera, doing Dutch angles. Stuff like that would fit into the composition.
Well, there are so many things that were groundbreaking about Saturday Night Fever. First of all, it was a musical, even though it was an organic musical. People went to clubs and danced, and those songs were a part of their lives. People don't just suddenly break into song and in the traditional musical form. But also, here comes John Travolta out of television doing Welcome Back, Kotter, and he was not a movie star. He'd done The Devil's Reign. But how did that happen? That was a big gamble on the part of a movie studio at Paramount at a time when television was the enemy of feature films.
They had decided, Stigwood and Alan Carr and Paramount, that they wanted to make Grease. And Travolta had been in Grease on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And He'd had some television success in not only Welcome Back, Kotter, but a movie for television called The Boy in the Plastic Bubble that Randall Kleiser directed.
Another film school grad from USC.
Yes. And so they made a three-picture deal with Travolta, who they felt they were getting for next to no money because he was just, you know, at a beginning stage. And the first picture would be Grease. However, they had to wait several months to start it because Olivia Newton-John had to clear her concert schedule to open up a big enough, you know, 12-week window to do this. In between, they're saying, what else can we do with this guy? When this magazine article came up, and suddenly this was Saturday Night Fever, what it became was something perfect to slot in while we're waiting for an Olivia Newton-John to show up, and it will introduce John to the world of movies. So that's how it started. and that was kind of some of the reason for the panic in getting another director involved when the first one was gone, because they were under the gun in terms of getting it finished. Right. I had to finish by a certain date because he had rehearsals by mid-May of that year, and we just barely finished shooting.
Wow!
And he had to go into rehearsals like a week and a half later.
In a couple of movies where he's in virtually every scene, yes.
Yeah, and he was in every scene.
Well, let's talk about Dracula. How did that come about? I know it was a big Broadway revival of the original Dracula story. Was this something that you pursued, or the studio came to you because of the success of your movie?
Well, Walter Mirisch came to me after Saturday Night Fever came out. And probably prodded by Ned Tannen and Tom Mount, who were not angry at me about The Wiz, because they were going to go ahead and make that anyway.
Right.
But I had a deal at Universal, an indentured, you know, servitude deal.
Yes.
And
one of those 8-year things.
Right. And I, you know, loved the original Dracula novel, which I had read and of course seen the Bela Lugosi films, but the Bram Stoker novel I thought was really, really interesting.
Yeah.
And I went to New York and saw Frank Langella doing it, and suddenly got an idea that what Langella brought to it was something that had never been done before, which was a very attractive, seductive Dracula, not an ugly guy with big teeth, but something that was very romantic. And like many bad things in our lives, they're often extremely attractive and seductive. And that's how people get drawn into them. They don't get drawn into, you know, big ugly monsters with horrible teeth and big fingernails.
Yes, you won't be seduced by the golem, yeah.
So we started to work on it from that point of view and took a different tact from the Broadway show, which had gone at it in a satirical way and said, well, let's do the old-fashioned 1924 Balderston and Dean play.
Right.
That was actually what was done for with Bela Lugosi.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do it that way, but we'll get drawings and scenery by Edward Gorey.
Right.
You know, like Charles Adams' black and white drawings, and all the scenery will be black and white and as though it's drawn on big pieces of paper. A library set, for example, would have all the books drawn right on the scenery.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, we can't do that. It's just not going to work in films.
No, there's a richness and an integrity to the movie that it takes itself so seriously. And that's one of its great strengths, I think, too. And you have Laurence Olivier as well as Frank Langella. I mean, this was a movie you took seriously.
Oh yeah, and you know, the treat of having Olivier be in it was just absolutely wonderful, because I do remember the very first movie I ever got to see in my life was Henry V.
Wow.
Directed by, you know, Laurence Olivier.
Yeah.
And as I would be talking to him on the set, I would say, "Sir, can we do this?" Or, "Sir, can we do that?" Larry,
so
dear boy.
If it was okay.
Larry, dear boy. And I said, it's really tough for me, you know. When I was 5 years old, I saw you in Henry V. It's really hard for me to call you Larry.
So what was that working relationship? Did you find yourself intimidated by this god of theater and film?
Well, yes, of course I was intimidated. Frank, I had known for several years because we both worked at the Williamstown Theater Festival.
Yeah.
And that was okay. And he was, you know, about my age too. So we understood each other. But then you had this icon of the English theater, you know, the greatest actor of the 20th century, arguably. And yet he was very kind. He was very ill at that point in his early 70s. He had serious cancer.
Mm.
And he had recovered enough so that he could do a film with George Roy Hill called A Little Romance.
Right.
They thought it was a miracle that he was able to ride a bicycle in that film, that he had gotten strong enough that he could ride a bicycle again. And that was a big deal. And this from an actor who was probably the bravest physical actor that we've ever had on the stage.
Mm.
I mean, a guy who would do physical things that nobody else would do in performing Coriolanus at the Royal Shakespeare, when Coriolanus is killed at the very end. Olivier was on a 12-foot high platform above the stage, and he's stabbed and he falls backwards toward the audience and is caught by his heels every night.
Oh man.
You know, however many times a week he was doing this, and that's the kind of physical actor that he typically was. And now to
that's
be
commitment.
At a point where it was hard for him to, you know, walk fast. So you have this, you know, man that have tremendous sympathy for, tremendous admiration for. But if he wanted to do something, you had to take him seriously.
Yeah.
And we had an incident one day where he has opened up Dracula's coffin, and he is supposed to take the host wafer, you know, the religious wafer, and break it in half and say over the coffin, "In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, I condemn thy spirit," or whatever. Olivier said to me, he said, "You know, my character is Dutch, and I think I should probably say this prayer in Dutch." And I said, "Oh, okay." He said, "You know, because in the church, it's heretical to pray in a language other than your natural language."
Oh, wow.
So I go, "Okay, all right." And we get to shooting it, and I suddenly start to think, I have visions of Walter Mirisch coming and looking over my shoulder and saying, "What the hell is he saying anyway?" And only Walter would be very polite in saying that. He would find a nice way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Okay, we've got the Dutch take. Would you mind doing one in English? And just in case there's a problem." And he says, "No, I will not do that. I told you it was heretical." And I said, "Well..." And I kind of started to go through my explanation again about, you know, what if we don't understand it? And we're now about 5 minutes to lunchtime.
Right.
And as we know, this is like a barrier you do not cross.
Right.
You got to get it and get out of there. And we don't want to come back to this set after lunch. We want to do something else. And he said, okay, fine, let's do it. Go ahead. I know we're up against lunch, so go ahead. We'll do an English version. Mm-hmm. And I run back behind the camera and rolling and everything, and I'm thinking, I know what he's going to do. He's just going to dog it through this take,
mm-hmm.
you know, and say, well, I did it. Right. And suddenly, he does it, like, perfectly. It could not be better. It's just, like, so beautifully done. And cut and print, and that's lunch, and okay, everybody out of here. And the whole crew is scurrying away from the set. And he says, John, come here. And I, yes, sir. No, Larry, dear boy here, but yes, sir. He said, I only did that take so as not to embarrass you in front of the crew. If you use it in the film, I'm calling a press conference to say that you lied to me.
Ooh, wow.
I said, yes, sir. Okay. Well, I could have probably saved myself the trouble if I'd never raised this thing in the first place, because
right.
it played just fine. He says it
it's
in
great.
Dutch in the film. Nobody ever raised a peep about
Why
it.
Would they?
And I'm yeah. kind of whacking myself on the head. I'm like Dobby in Harry Potter, you know. Bad Dobby, bad Dobby.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have had this great story.
I know. So, that's true.
Did you like scary movies as a kid?
I did. Yeah. Well,
What were the ones that you watched?
All of the comic books, the scary comic books, you know, Tales from the Crypt and
really?
Stuff like that. Yeah. I loved those things.
Right. And the movies as well, the Universal classics. And I mean, you remade one of them. So.
Yes. Well, the Universal classics, even the picture of Dorian Gray, which terrified me. I hid under the seat of the theater
right.
for half the movie.
Wow. Yeah.
But yes, I really do like those. And that's why I was so attracted to Night Gallery.
Yeah.
And The Sixth Sense and the shows that I've been doing recently.
Roy Thinnes on The Sixth Sense, right?
Yes. Gary.
Oh, yes. I know who you mean.
Yes. Not Roy was in The
Gary
Psychiatrist.
Lockwood?
Gary Collins.
Gary Collins, that was it. Yeah. They're interchangeable. So, what was your concept for Dracula? Was there an overarching emotion that you wanted to tap into? Was it the marriage of romance and fear, the gothic quality of it that you wanted to revive, because there wasn't much of that in 1979 when the movie was made?
Well, you wanted to bring to it a richness, a production quality that had really never been brought to these movies, because they were all made on such low budget.
Yeah.
Even the Hammer films
of
the time, which started to move in a different direction from the Universal pictures. I mean, first of all, they were the first horror movies done in color.
Right. Garishly so.
And very, very garish, but interesting interpretations of Christopher Lee as Frankenstein. And, you know, everything had a fresh look to it. But now we wanted to make something that had this, combined this very romantic quality with the very eerie, strange quality of what the Dracula character brought to it, but also the insane asylum. The insane asylum you know, a big part of that period of time. We set it around, 1913, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And just when the world was changing in terms of technology, horses and buggies were still there, but cars were just coming in.
Right.
Women were starting to fight. That was the year that the woman threw herself in front of the horses at the big racetrack in England as a suffragette protesting the lack of votes. So, the women were raising things, and we thought that's interesting for the character of Lucy.
Right. So the horror genre has often been a great way to act as a platform for social commentary without it feeling like a sledgehammer to the head. And this is a perfect example of that.
So we wanted to make the character of Lucy a very strong woman. Mm-hmm. And that's why we cast Kate Nelligan.
Right.
Who was, you know, not just another pretty face.
Yeah.
You know, a very beautiful woman, but very tough and very strong, and you always felt it in her acting, and on the set, her boyfriend in the film was played by Trevor Eve, and she, I think she intimidated him for almost most of the shoot. He was terrified.
That sounds good for the movie.
Yes.
How would you describe yourself as a filmmaker? I know you've taught in film schools at Chapman and various places, and encouraging young filmmakers and the like. But as far as your work goes, it's so incredibly versatile, and so many genres so well handled and self-contained. How would you describe what you do as a filmmaker? What your philosophy is?
Well, I think I'm more of an interpreter than an innovator.
Hmm.
And an interpreter in the way that, you know, many singers can interpret different songs. They didn't write the songs,
right,
but they bring whatever they bring to it as part of them. And when I get involved in something, I always try to get involved with something that I really enjoy, because I know that I'll be able to get inside of it and very respectfully approach what did the screenwriter intend. I'm here because I like what the screenwriter is doing, right, not because I intend to reinvent thing. Can I add stuff to it that helps it, that enhances what the screenwriter was doing? Yes. That I can bring, a point of view to what the screenwriter intended. So that's always a big part of my goal, is trying to get inside of that. So when doing a film like Short Circuit, mm-hmm, you know, I'm coming at it from the point of view of understanding the robot.
Right.
You know.
Robots have perspective too.
And you know, how is this creature seeing the world?
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about that? And the humor of it was tremendous amount of humor. In fact, we learned in the making of that film that you couldn't stop putting funny things in there. We kept adding dialogue in post-production all the time, almost up to the day of release of the film. Uh-huh. You know, somebody would think of a joke and you could stick it in number five's mouth because yeah, there was no sink to worry about.
Right, right.
And almost anything would work. And the more we did, the more the audience enjoyed it. And the more effective it was.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there was a tremendous synchronicity between my brain, the writer's brain, and number five and the puppeteers.
Right.
You know, that worked really strongly, and I felt like that was because I really got it in the first place, right away, and was right inside of it. I really got Saturday Night Fever. And War Games.
I mean, all these hits. For somebody who doesn't know anything about how a movie is made, how would you describe the job of the director?
Well, you have to guide a whole company of people, from actors, cameramen, editors, sound designers, grips, through a vision that you have of what kind of film, what kind of story you want to tell. But for me, you guide it with their help, not with them enslaved to your vision. Mm-hmm. I'm a great, great believer in collaboration. And part of that is, the good part is that you're getting feedback and interesting ideas from everyone. The bad part is that you have to sort out what works and what doesn't. Yeah. You can't take everyone's idea. You know, some things may be great ideas, but they don't work for your particular film.
And only one person can make all of those decisions.
And only one person, sometimes two people who are very close together, the Coen brothers.
Right.
The Farrellys, you know, those kind of people that work so hand in hand with each other. But somebody has to be the captain of the ship. You can't have the ship going off in two directions at once.
Right.
And that's really part of the challenge of how to utilize all the input that you're now encouraging people to give you. Mm. And, you know, the other directors are saying, no, it's my way or the highway. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear from these other people. This is how we're going to do it.
Right.
No names, please, on location.
Yes. But
there are plenty of people who like to work that way. And I'm not intimidated by other people's ideas. Mm-hmm. And I think I know how to handle them, mm-hmm. even when they are the worst ideas ever.
Yeah.
But my job in rejecting people's ideas is to keep them so they want to keep coming back with
right.
more
no.
and not have them just shut up and put out of business. Because certainly the fastest way, you know, to get somebody to stop talking to you is to say, that's the dumbest idea I ever heard. You know, why would you do that? And then that's the last you'll ever hear from.
Right. You want to keep them on the team. Yeah. Over all of the years you're doing this, you're still going strong and working, doing imaginative television when you're not doing movies. You're bouncing between media and the like. Last week, you did an episode of Siren that aired, and this is a mermaid tale. So all of this incredibly diverse material you've worked with, what stands out to you that maybe is something that has not been as widely seen as some of your huge box office hits and big TV things? What do you wish people would see that best reflects what you do?
A film I made with Richard Dreyfuss called Whose Life Is It Anyway, which I really loved because it had a human being in an almost impossible kind of circumstance and a very real life kind of dilemma that you find you have a terminal illness that in Dreyfuss' particular case was going to be, you know, completely paralyzed, left only with his voice. And how do you deal with that? Well, looking at it from a very humanistic point of view, not where we want the hero to succeed as much as we want to just talk about this issue of how do you deal with your life? That's something that Richard and I were really taken with, and why he wanted to do the film, and to say, here we can do something that is not depressing,
right?
That actually has a lot of humor to it.
Mm-hmm.
The character has great intelligence and humor, and that kind of makes you want him to have what he wants. Want him to not necessarily make the easy choice of saying, no, I'm going to fight this forever, just to say, I'm done with this. This is okay. Mm-hmm. My choice is I don't want to, you know, stay alive if I have to be here in this frozen kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, things have changed dramatically so that, you know, there is hope for people who are paralyzed to be able to recover. You know, things that the technology keeps growing, You know, it was better with Christopher Reeve, mm-hmm. you know, where he was able to keep working and keep acting and directing right. at the same time and regeneration of nerves. But at that time, you know, you were faced with being, you know, a piece of cabbage in a bed.
Right.
Or saying, no, I'm going to be brave and just say, that's it. That's what I'm doing. So anyway. That I didn't mean to get on a horse about that.
No, but movies are about stories, and they're about people, and they're about experiences.
I was just completely, caught up in this guy's dilemma. Yeah. Like, what would you do? You know, how would you deal with this? And trying to deal with it with humor and intelligence is what the character is doing, but still saying, I don't want to exist in this particular way.
It's an incredibly powerful movie, and I'm hoping that people will seek it out after this conversation. John, thank you so much. We could easily go another couple of hours, and hopefully we will in the future. But thank you for joining us on Postmortem. I really appreciate seeing you 40 years after we did our first interview for the Z Channel.
Yeah, but we're here.
We are.
Isn't this great? We're here. We're still doing this.
Still doing what we do. And it's great. And doing really excellent work. I love keeping up with what you're doing.
You know, I did a film about skydiving a few years ago with Wesley Snipes in it. And he was playing a detective, an agent of the federal government. And gets involved against his will into the world of skydiving. Mm-hmm. So we've got to have somebody who can double him, because we're going to be up there. We want to have somebody that looks like Wesley, because we're not going to let him do it.
No,
even though he said, no, I'll do it. I'll do it.
Oh, you know, I bet.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure you would, but, the insurance company is saying absolutely not.
Yes.
So our stunt coordinator, who was in charge of all the skydiving, comes up with a guy from St. Louis who's physically just like Wesley, who's this dark. Wesley has very dark skin, mm-hmm. and was a really good skydiver. He comes on the set, and I'm sitting by him one day, and I said, what do you do when you're not skydiving? He said, oh, I work in the Chevrolet assembly plant in St. Louis.
Wow.
And I said, oh. And I had visions of team building and things like that. I said, well, what's your job there? He said, I put in 204 rearview mirrors every day. And I thought, oh, my God. Oh, my God, can you imagine doing that 5 days a week, mm-hmm. you know, 50 weeks a year? And here we get to do in making films what we do, where every day it's a different challenge. Almost every scene is a different challenge.
Yeah.
And here's, you know, this guy that's got this mind-deadening, numbing kind of task. Thank God that we're so lucky that we can do this.
So lucky. I mean, I every day I appreciate what a great situation we have. You know, life is good.
It is good.
John Badham, thank you for being a great guest and joining Postmortem. And let's do it again soon.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here.
If you're enjoying Postmortem, it would be a great, great favor to us for you to rate and review and subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can access all of my video interviews and behind-the-scenes documentaries, things like that, at mickgarrisinterviews.com. Reach us on Twitter at PostmortemMG and on Instagram on PostmortemGram. Thanks a lot for listening.
Thanks for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every other Wednesday and subscribe on iTunes.